So thank you very much for this opportunity. I know that you are having a meeting here in Lisbon, and you were awarded with some scholarships. The purpose of your work is to foster pan-European debate on certain critical issues concerning democracy in Europe. Okay. And there were in the paper that I read at least three of those critical issues that were pointed out: rule of law, the shifting political landscape in Europe. It seems like a diplomat writing, meaning the rise of populism, I suppose, and democracy in general. So we have half an hour, so perhaps you want to make some statements or put me some questions. Ines Krowa, she's my diplomatic advisor. I would spend 5 minutes of your time trying to answer to this question. From a Portuguese point of view, what are the main challenges we are facing, our democracy is facing? Perhaps you know that our democracy is a quite recent one. The democratic transition occurred only in 1974. According to some political scientists, the Carnation Revolution in Portugal was the first event of what would be a third wave of democratization in Europe, first in the southern Europe, Portugal, Greece, Portugal, and Spain, and then in the eastern Europe. But until 1974, we had a dictatorship and a colonial empire, as you can see. This decoration dates from the 40s, and of course you can see several evidence of colonialism, prejudice, racism, xenophobia, and so on. I would say that our democracy is a rather consolidated one, a mature one. One of our founding fathers, to say this way, Mário Soares, always said that the new democracy, the democratization in Portugal, had to be in parallel with European integration, because that's the best way to anchor the new pluralist, multi-party parliamentary system that we were launching the context of social and economic development, then can offer material and practical responses to the citizens' needs. This regime that comes from the 70s was never challenged in Portugal until very recently. Now we have a quite important populist far-right party in our parliament, and one can say that for the first time the democratic constitution in Portugal is being challenged. But according to the formal criteria, freedom of press, individual liberties, liberty, freedom of association, respect for ethnicity, religious beliefs, human rights. I would say that Portugal ranks among the best democracies in Europe and within the European Union. Our challenge is the level of participation, of political participation, namely among the youngsters. I left my research in political science some years ago because I became a subject of research and not a researcher. But when I was a teacher of political science, the data collected in Portugal suggested that half of the youngsters below 30 years old never voted, not because they were impeded, but because they didn't want. So the abstention among the youngsters is our challenge number one for the democracy, because it's rather problematic to know if this is an issue of aging, meaning that people becoming older would vote more frequently, or if this is an issue of generation, meaning that democratic institutions mean less and less for the new generations. I would suggest that there is at least a component of this second factor, because nobody in Portugal questions the fact that we live in a free country. It's like the air you breathe. So the question is how far the party system, the electoral system, and the political institutions in Portugal respond to the new causes, the new needs, and in a certain way, the new anxiety of youngsters. So I would say that this is problem number one in the Portuguese democracy, and I would suggest that this is a general trend in Europe right now and not only a Portuguese singularity. So, what do you think about?
Well, I mean, of course. I'm the academic advisor of the program. And you mentioned several things. I'm coming from Hungary, and for this reason, I could ask a lot of things about your stake on populism, but actually, what do you think, what's the reason? You mentioned that in Portugal, no one really questions the democratic institutions. That's not really the case in Hungary. And so my question is, what do you think, what are the differences between the populist forces in Portugal or in Eastern Europe, specifically in Hungary?
I would say that the far-right populism, because there is also a far-left populism, and the populism is transversal to the party system. I belong to the center-left ruling party in Portugal, coming from the Party of the European Socialists, so I belong to the Labour, Social Democrat, Socialist family, and of course there is also populism in my party, but populism does not is not hegemonic in my party, and it is hegemonic in the extreme right wing of our political spectrum. But I would say that our party belonged to that family, adopted as its first stage the second Marine Le Pen. This means it tries to capture the social agenda of the middle class and of the lower classes that have the sentiment of being abandoned, one, by globalization, and second, by identity politics. So it's not a question of xenophobia, because the enemy, you know, populism needs to cultivate enemies. The enemy is a national one, because gypsies in Portugal are Portuguese people, and traditionally Portuguese people, they are not foreigners. Half of the foreigners living in Portugal come from Portuguese-speaking countries, so the ordinary man or woman does not consider them foreigners because they speak the same language, they love codfish as we do, and they are Catholic as we are. So I would say that the main challenges this new strength of the far-right populism poses to us in Portugal is the fact that they are conquering the margins of traditional electorate for my party, the Socialist Party, and mostly for the Communist Party, exactly as in the French case. So they don't say we love Putin, they don't say we want to leave NATO, they don't say we want to leave the European Union, they don't say we don't want foreigners living near us. They don't say we love the autocrats because the democrats are weak people. No, they say there are lots of people, poor people living in poor conditions that are threatened because you, the elites, you only care of the so-called cultural or moral issues, and you are abandoning the country in favor of globalism. So it's quite different from Hungary, because here we don't have any kind of fight between judges and politicians, or if we have, is the other way around. In Portugal, nowadays, I think things are quite normalized, but the influence of the judicialization of politics in the Italian way, Di Petro, or in Spanish way, Garzón, was quite important, but I think this kind of fashion has already passed away. Passed away. Sorry. Yeah, gone. I was too sincere.
So I'm Nicholas Langen, and I'm at the Pantheon Sorbonne in Paris. And sort of following on from your question there, following on from what you were suggesting about the judicialization of politics, and I was just thinking about the Rwanda decision in the UK yesterday, that's with the ECHR stopping the deportation of refugees to Rwanda. And considering that I know there's the major climate case being brought by some Portuguese children before the European Court of Human Rights, and I was just wondering about how the Portuguese people and the Portuguese political class were responding to sort of judicial decisions on human rights and touching on more political matters, particularly issues like climate change.
Well, in the English case, the rule of the European Court of Human Rights against the deportation of migrants to Rwanda, this is not judges playing politics. This is just judges doing their work, because if you take illegal decisions, the courts have to stop your decisions. So I don't mean, when I mean judicialization of politics, I mean things like, for instance, judges or prosecutors trying to dispute in court political decisions. It's quite so, no doubt on that. Secondly, there is a problem with our judicial system, because the way we consider human rights criteria is more restrictive than the way the European Court for Human Rights does. And of course, the problem is ours. Not the problem does not lie on Strasbourg, lies on our tradition. For instance, many judicial authorities in Portugal have very important programs of awareness of judges, including judges of the superior courts, in order that they understand fully what means the expression domestic violence, or violence against women, or violence against minors. Because traditionally, or for certain sectors of our justice system, you know, there are always cultural reasons or a kind of logic of assessment of temptation and not assessment of crime. So we still need to have programs of training of young or older judges in order that everyone understands that yes means yes, and not saying yes means no, and any kind of violence has to be penalized or interdicted. So I would say that in all these cases, the judge, the judiciary plays its role and not goes beyond its mission.
Susana Croado.
Okay.
Boa tarde, Susana Croado, do Instituto de Ciências Sociais da Universidade de Lisboa e da Transparência Internacional de Portugal. I will switch to English now so my colleagues can understand. Well, it's a privilege to be here because not only you're the Speaker of the Parliament, but until a couple of months ago you were also the Minister of Foreign Affairs. And I remember that the Portuguese government was against rule of law conditionalities in the allocation of EU recovery funds. So I would like to ask you your views on the rule of law issues in the EU right now. Thank you.
Yeah, we were not against the conditionality. The only thing we said is that a fine should not resolve the problems of Hungary and Poland with the rule of law. It's quite a different thing to say. So during our presidency of the Council of the European Union, we moved forward Article 7 procedures. They were suspended during the Croatia and the German presidency, and it was during the first semester of last year, under the Portuguese presidency, that finally we realized the public hearings necessary to move ahead the procedures against Hungary and Poland concerning criteria of rule of law. Secondly, we promoted with the European Commission, in that case, prolonging the work of the Germans, the new mechanism of assessment of all member states of the European Union under the criteria of rule of law. Thirdly, we supported the European Commission and the European Council, the decision taken by the European Council, according to which the disposal of funds to any member state demanded that this member state respects criteria of rule of law. So it would have to include a conditionality clause. It was approved, and then the European Commission approved the necessary regulation, and the same criterion was also applied to this new mechanism of resilience. So it is a wrong statement saying the Portuguese government was against any of those procedures. On the contrary, we move ahead with all of them. But finally, we said that the discount of a certain amount of money to Poland or to Hungary because of the difficulties of these member states with certain basic values and principles of the European democracy, this discount, this kind of fine, could not resolve a problem that was not a problem of funds, that was not an economic problem, but was a problem of abiding by the basic principles of the European Union.
Andy Orjay from University of Warwick in the UK. My research is on rule of law, but from the EU foreign policy. My question is, next week the European Council will decide whether Ukraine should get the EU candidacy or not. And there is a new debate now about reforming enlargement policy. And I was wondering, what is the Portuguese position when it comes to reforming enlargement policy? And since there is a new discussion now to amend EU treaties, in particular when it comes to decision-making process in EU foreign policy to include qualified majority voting, is your position to also extend that into enlargement policy? Because at the moment, when you see at the Western Balkans, North Macedonia, it's a candidate since 2005. Greece blocked it because of the name issue, and now Bulgaria is blocking it. And Bulgaria's condition, it's completely not related to the conditions, because they are saying that North Macedonia should retreat from asking to recognize a North Macedonian minority in Bulgaria. So if we are going to have sort of this veto into every single stage when it comes to enlargement, it's counterproductive to the work that the Commission does. So is your position to reform this and to have qualified majority, meaning that all of the EU members vote at the beginning to open accession, and then in the end, everybody votes whether you should accede or not, and not to every single chapter of the acquis there should be a voting?
Thank you very for your question, and allow me to elaborate a little on your. The Portuguese government position is that this is not a time for a new review, a new institutional debate. We can live with unanimity concerning certain aspects of fiscal policy, foreign policy, and defense policy, and the passerelle closed, anticipated in Lisbon Treaty, is enough to manage to go further without a formal review of the treaties. The position of the Parliament is as follows. The Parliament is quite divided. Of course, the party that supports the government aligns itself with the government. The main party, the main opposition party, is now moving in order to accept the end of the unanimity. But still, it has no clear decision or position by now, but they are now having a new leader, so let's see what's happened. My personal position is this one. Consensus is very important, and in areas of clear national sovereignty, consensus and even unanimity is a virtue, is a strength. But consensus means that we all tend to form a common position, and no one is allowed to have the right to veto or to practice a veto. So my criticism, my harsher criticism to Hungary, is that they are not complying by our rule, because our rule is to form consensus and not to veto common positions. And they are vetoing several crucial decisions concerning China, concerning Russia, concerning the rule of law, and so on. So your depends on what is the body that you are interpolating. Sorry, I'm looking at my clock because I have to breathe. Now, but we have 5 minutes.
Okay, maybe a question about your... I'm about also the University of Leuven in Belgium. Maybe a question about your current position as president of the parliament. As a political scientist, you know that an important democratic problem is a decline of parliaments, right? Parliaments are getting weaker or unable to scrutinize the government. How would you assess the situation in Portugal? What could be improved to strengthen the position of the Portuguese parliament? And wouldn't it be a good idea to have an apolitical speaker in parliament that doesn't attend political meetings, for example? Wouldn't that improve the situation? It's maybe a bit of a provocative question, I know, but...
Sorry, I didn't understand.
The last part was...
Non-political speaker.
A non-political... Like in the UK, for example, the speaker does not attend political meetings, so it can have a stronger position of the institution vis-à-vis the government.
Yeah, the British love so much the Queen that they try to make copies or avatars of the Queen. No, I'm not in favor. I think that we need politicians, we need party politicians, and the Speaker of the Parliament, which is has only one chamber. The position of the Speaker is to represent institutionally all the Parliament, but also to represent the majority of the Parliament. The Parliament has a very crucial role of representation, taking the control on basic issues like individual rights and liberties and taxation, and to be the body from which emerges the government. For example, you don't need in Portugal to be the party with more seats in the parliament to become the party ruling the government. Because you need to form a majority in the party. Right now, there is a single party majority, but before there were necessary at least four parties to form this majority. From my personal point of view, it's very interesting because I am in a certain apprenticeship, because I'm quite a veteran in Portuguese politics, but my career, I served most of the time as member of a cabinet. I'm not a professional politician, so I'm a professor at university. But by now I could count 15 years and a half as a politician, a full job politician. And of these 15 and a half years, 20 of them were in the government. So it's quite challenging for me being now on the other side. I was for 4 years and a half Minister of Parliamentary Affairs, meaning that I was here every day defending the government. So now I have to incorporate a new persona. Let's see if I manage. Okay, last question.
Bon dia. My name is Theo. I'm from Sciences Po Paris in France. I had two questions, but I swear I will limit myself to one. So we are in this room, which is striking indeed by the paintings, and you mentioned it. And the person who gave us the visit also said that we should never forget history, which is indeed true. But then I know that so I'm a specialist of democratic transitions, and I know that there is always the moment in the democratic transitions about amnesty, about forgetting the past in order to move forward. But generally speaking, what's the current debate on Portugal colonial history nowadays? I know it's booming in many countries, in France more and more, in the UK of course, but also among academia. So what's, and is this something, because you mentioned the youth, is it something that also the youth relates to somehow, or is it perhaps this missing element that you are looking for involving the youth?
I think the debate in Portugal is just starting. I don't know what would be Susanna's opinion, but I will give mine. There are some singularities of the Portuguese history that we have to take into account. The first one is this one. In a certain way, opposite to the Dutch or to the British or to the French experience, we, and in a certain way, partially also the Spanish, we were a small country that in a certain way exhausted itself and its resources because of the magnitude of the world it ruled in a certain period of time of 3-4 centuries. Secondly, there are some singularities in the history of our relation with former colonies that explain that debate in Portugal was not very vocal. For example, we are right now celebrating 200th of independence of Brazil. And at the invitation of the Brazilian authorities, we are part of that celebration, including the fact that the formal celebration of the second centenary of the independence in Brazil next 7th September in Brasilia, in the Brazilian Congress, will be attended by the Portuguese President of the Republic and by myself at the Brazilian invitation. The independence during more than a decade, Rio de Janeiro was the capital of the Portuguese Empire. It's the only empire in history in which, during a certain period of time, the capital was not in the metropolitan area, but in a colony. Then the guy who declared the independence of Brazil was the Crown Prince of Portugal. He became emperor of Brazil, then he resigned, and he became to Portugal and was our king. So it's like a mixture of things. Because we were not a developed country, the way in which we saw the native populations and the native populations saw us was much more closer than it occurred, for instance, with the British and the Indians in India. So that are these sort of things that explain the debate in Portugal is quite underrepresented during many years, and it was necessary that we had for the first time MP that was Afro-descendant to emerge in this parliament, this debate. And now there is a debate ongoing on what should we do to this, to preserve and to assume that we were these kind of guys, to transform it, to hide this, to put here in a certain dialogue or dialectics with this new murals representing the oppression, for instance. I think this debate will happen in Portugal, and I would say that we are in the first stages of this debate. So, sorry, I have to go do my work. Thank you very much for this occasion. Okay. You know, Salazar, our dictator, was very reluctant to the foundation of a Catholic university in Portugal, because he loved